This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Muggs. Since the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen how poor minority communities are being hit inordinately hard. So we begin our look at local health disparities with Iris Rowley. She's the board chair of Community Economic Advancement Initiatives, and she joins us on the phone. Iris, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you so very much for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you, and we certainly want to discuss the health disparities from your perspective in your community. But I also want to talk to you a little bit about some news that broke late last night from reporters Sharon Coolidge and Dan Horn at the Cincinnati Inquirer about a shakeup at the Cincinnati Health Department. Cincinnati Health Commissioner Melba Moore apparently no longer running day-to-day operations at the city's health department. She will still be leading the city's pandemic response, according to Mayor John Cranley, but the assistant health commissioner, Dominic Hobson, is now the chief executive officer there. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that shakeup in the city's health department.
Well, I'm very curious about the title of the article about the crumbling and the health department coming down or falling down as Commissioner Moore being the health commissioner. I'm also concerned because Commissioner Moore and CEAI, we've had several conversations around testing, PPE, education, a lot in this particular, around this particular pandemic and its issues. And even it's even greater for us because we are African-Americans in the city of Cincinnati. And as we watch the dashboards that the health department, by way of the state, provides us, and we see that where the infection is traveling and who are the people who are dying at a considerable rate and greater than other people, it is African-Americans. So it's very troubling to see that article, one. It's very troubling to see this article because I keep up with what's happening in my town and what's going on. Right now, health is it. And so watching health department meetings and not hearing any of what I'm reading about in the newspaper, not understanding what the shakeup is about or why to, because it seems like it is a demotion when you read it. And then three for me as a lifelong Cincinnatian and an extremely engaged taxpayer on multiple levels. It always bothers me when we see African Americans being drug in the media of their, you know, their professional public life, but to be torn down in a way that it's impossible to rebuild your life and have a career outside of Cincinnati. And I just don't understand why that happens. So on multiple levels, it's extremely concerning. And I can run a list down to you. And you already know we've had these conversations before around African-American leadership in the city of Cincinnati, and why must we be treated differently than other leadership in the city? But the most importantly is right now in this pandemic, and even though the numbers that I received on Friday, we didn't see a rise, we still don't know what the opening up of the city of Cincinnati with the state of Ohio will cause us in the next couple of weeks. So I am extremely concerned by what is taking place at the city level, and why is it not done in a more humane way, in a way that we can understand, and in a way that certainly not to demean or demote Commissioner Moore.
And make
taxpayers a little nervous. This should make us nervous in the midst of this pandemic.
You're talking, of course, about the reopening of some areas of the economy, particularly restaurants, on Friday, and your curiosity about the impact that could have on the number of positive COVID-19 cases we have in our community?
Yes, sir. Yes, I am. And knowing that we have not seen the abundance of testing that should happen, we should see way more testing. You asked me to come on this call so we could talk about how we were able to get a site in Bond Hill in a predominantly Black neighborhood where Black people who either are frontline workers or of that particular age in their senior time, frontline workers, people who could potentially have been exposed to someone who has been positive to COVID, or someone, a pregnant woman. So you invited me on to talk about that. But if you look around the city and if you look at that heat map and you see the zip codes where the infection rate is happening, why are we not seeing a bigger push? Not just from our city officials, but we certainly have three or four private healthcare systems. And why don't we see more testing? Why don't we see more education, on-the-ground education? Why don't we see a bigger push for contact tracers to understand, especially since we're opening back up some businesses? My business has not, but as we see restaurants opening, we're talking about opening up summer camps and these things. Why are we not preparing for what we could potentially, what could potentially happen? If you study what happened in 1917, 18, and 19, you know when the government had a huge rally, I believe it was in New York in 1918, that caused a third round. So we should be willing to look at what happened prior to 2020. What did they do so we don't do it? What can we do better? Looking at other nations, seeing what are they doing so we can either follow if they're currently getting out of it, if they're flattening their numbers, if the death rate is going down. What are we doing? So I'm just very concerned about, you know, the whole gist of it, the whole kit and caboodle. What is the comprehensive overall plan for the city of Cincinnati, and how are we going to address these issues in a way where we can mitigate the spread and the death, in particular in the Black community?
And we're talking with Iris.
COVID-19.
We're talking with Iris Rowley. She's the board chair of the Community Economic Advancement Initiatives. And Iris, you just referenced a heat map, and this is a graphic created by the Cincinnati Health Department. The latest one that we have here is from March 18th through May 3rd, and it divides the city up into its defined neighborhood boundaries and shades them a darker shade of blue depending on where the higher number of cases are. And so what we see based on this illustration is that the neighborhood impacted the most in terms of number of positive cases of COVID-19 appears to be Westwood, and then close behind we see West Price Hill, Lower Price Hill, but we also see in the third tier, Avondale, Evanston, Bond Hill, Pleasant Ridge, College Hill, Mount Airy. Tell us a little bit about what this graphic means to you based on the population of those neighborhoods.
Well, what it means to me is that we have very vulnerable people who don't understand the gravity and the depth of what is occurring. If you and I can see this, and this is because we pay close attention, are people in the community really getting this information? Do they understand how important it is to pay attention to symptoms, how important it is to wear masks, how important it is to do hand washing in a very aggressive way, and to make sure that you self-isolate yourself, making sure that people have the correct information? Are we clearly doing this in the city of Cincinnati based on these maps, based on what we're getting from our health department? What are we collectively doing? And then what is the collective plan to help reduce these numbers, to help reduce the dark blue that you and I see on these screens? And then thirdly, what's the long-term plan with the healthcare systems inside of the city? What are they prepared to do? We should see masks in abundance in the city of Cincinnati. We should have disposable mask boxes, especially in the communities where we see it keep tiltering for weeks in this dark blue area. I think Westwood has been on here for about 2.5-3 weeks being dark blue. But what are we doing outside of that?
And Iris, what are you seeing in the Black community in terms of a personal response to this pandemic? Are you seeing the community responding in what health officials would consider a responsible way, such as wearing masks and being cognizant of hand washing and social distancing?
I see people who have the access to the PPE responding in that way. I see people who have access to the information trying to respond in that way, but I see very scared and frightened people. I see people before the pandemic living in a pandemic of injustice and oppression and lack of resources. So I see people, then I see some people who don't believe it because they have very limited trust in government based on where they were prior to this. So you see a mixture of a lot of things, just like we see a lot of people at the State House, you know, fighting to open back up the city. So you see a lot of things that probably would be different if leadership was clear, concise, deliberate, and intentional about the instructions. This is the time where government should be leading us. We should be taking a lot of our information and assuming that it's true, because then they should be listening to the doctors and the scientists, right? So we should be able to get information that would help extend our lives, not end our lives, not become more sick. So when you ask about what do I see in these very poor neighborhoods, I see people trying to survive daily. I see people worried about the little good job that they had that didn't even make ends meet before that they can't go to now. I see people worried about, you know, who's going to take care of the kids if I have to go back to work. I see a lot of people worried about a lot of things and just not having the ability to have some semblance of faith in people that they should and the systems that they should, and you know, so that they can make better decisions. That's what I see on a daily basis. But we're out. I also see good people out trying to mitigate that. I see church people out trying to make sure that the people have PPE. I see organizations trying to come together to make sure that the education is occurring. So I see some hope, but I also see a lot of worry and a lot of frustration and a lot of confusion.
And again, we're talking with Iris Rowley, Board Chair of Community Economic Advancement Initiatives. And Iris, we wanted to discuss today specifically the testing facility in Bond Hill that came through Mercy Health. Can you talk a little bit about how that particular testing program came about?
Sure. That came about because CEAI, let me say this about CEAI. We started because of another shortage in the Black community. We were seeing a lot of development happening. We were seeing Black people being pushed out. We were seeing a lot of gentrification. We were not seeing the access to property, to ownership. We were seeing the takeovers of communities. We've watched over the Rhine be taken over. We're watching Walnut Hills and Avondale. So Black leaders came together and started the Community Economic Advancement Initiative. And we came about to help Black folks stay as owners and be participants in land ownership and development. And so we came together based on that. In this relationship, we are doing development in the communities of Bond Hill and Roselawn. We became aware of Bon Secours, Mercy Health, wanting to do development. So we were introduced and built a relationship with Bon Secours, Mercy Health in Baltimore. I reached out to Dr. Sam Ross in Baltimore and asked if he could help us in the city of Cincinnati begin to look at how we could set up a testing site in a Black community, considering that, you know, Mercy Health has buildings erected all through the city and the county. And he said, absolutely, I can help you with that, Iris Rowley. And he made a call to Wayne Bohannock. I think I'm saying his last name correctly. He is the chief pharmaceutical officer for Bon Secours Mercy Health. I hope I got his job title right, but it sounded like he was the boss. He called me on a Saturday, and I told him what our concerns were and what we were seeing, and we were following the numbers, and could he assist us, and he said that he could. And then I called our president of CEAI, which is Pastor Damon Lynch III, and we all got on the call, and it took us about 2.5 weeks to negotiate terms and agreements who would do what, where the site would actually be, hours and things of that sort, and that's how it came about.
And are you seeing a positive response to it?
Absolutely. To date, I think the site has seen upward to 1,050-something people. 81 of them were positive, plus 39 pending. But just having something in a community where Black people did not have access to a testing site. Now, let me say this. Bon Secours Mercy Health had already had 4 sites in the outlayers of the city. So I know one was at Jewish Hospital, Forest Hills. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head.
Well, that's okay. We'll actually be talking to someone from Mercy next, so
yeah.
don't worry.
So they had testing sites, but they were not in the city proper and not where people who have transportation issues, who don't have a direct medical physician, may not have a doctor, didn't have access to proper information, what the symptoms were around COVID. Is it different than sinus? Is it different than the flu? Is it different than a cold? So we wanted to help any healthcare system provide opportunities for all people to be able to get testing. And so we made that happen there at Bond Hill at the Mercy site, Professional Health Building. And we're grateful to Mercy for setting that site up there. It's still up and running. People are still going. We do a lot of advertising, a lot of marketing for it. And we're very proud that we were able to sit at the table with the leadership of Bond Secure Mercy Health to get that site in Bond Hill.
Iris, before we let you go, I'm curious what your thoughts might be, because you reference the health disparities that existed and the injustice that existed in these communities prior to the pandemic beginning. What do you hope that the broader community learns about that once we find ourselves on the other side of this current health crisis?
I think our former president said it eloquently this weekend when he did the commencement speeches, is that the pandemic has exposed a lot of the inequities that people were, people talked about, but we see. You guys know that for the past 20 years, we've been working on fighting for, supporting, producing, working on police reform in the city of Cincinnati. I just went through numbers of people who were hit with the stay-in-place order. I think it's 112 of them, and the majority of them were African-American people. Now, if you looked at the photos that you saw this weekend, you saw tons of non-African-Americans out, tons of non-African-American-owned non-African-American-owned businesses with people who were clearly violating recommendations, rules, orders, what have you. But none of them were hit, and none of them were talked about the way that African-Americans were. So it's, you know, we were being arrested before the pandemic in a disproportionate way, and we're still being arrested and cited in a disproportionate way based on the numbers that we've collected from the court system. So we weren't, you know, when people talk about going back to normal, I don't think I want to go back to normal. I think I want to go back to better and different. And I want to go back to a commitment with the people who are responsible and accountable to making sure that all life matters, and making sure that the people who are at the top of this very nasty, ugly bucket, who are being infected and who are dying, that can have access to healthcare information, access to testing, access to any treatment that may be available, and certainly access to anything that comes after that. So that's what I'm talking about.
Iris Rowley is board chair of Community Economic Advancement Initiatives. Iris, thank you so much for your time today. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
And Mercy Hospital is one of the few offering COVID-19 testing opportunities to local communities of color. We have that conversation next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Mercy Health opened a drive-through COVID-19 and flu testing clinic in Bond Hill for residents there and in the surrounding community. And joining us now to talk about the importance of opening that clinic is Dr. Brianna McFaughn. She's the medical director of primary care at Mercy Health Physicians. Dr. McFaughn, thank you for being with us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to join and to talk about our flu testing site in Bond Hill.
Well, we're glad to have you, certainly, and I know it's a busy time for healthcare workers like you. Before we dive into the Bond Hill questions, how are you doing? How is your team doing?
We're doing great. I think for physicians, it's just part of the role that we play to be there for other people. That's what drives us to be physicians. So when there are people in need and we need to take care of our community, it really activates us. And it's when we can really serve our best purpose.
What are you hearing from folks who are calling into the office or asking you questions? What are their big concerns right now?
They still really are concerned about when it is safe to leave their home and what procedures they need to take to keep themselves safe, as well as concerns about exposure and questions about symptoms that might be related to COVID-19.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Bond Hill testing facility and its significance.
So we opened the Bond Hill testing facility on April 22nd, and really to expand access to health services in that area as well as neighboring communities like Avondale. The lead clinic physician is Dr. Melvin. He actually lives in the Bond Hill neighborhood and is very committed to that neighborhood and works in the Avondale practice. What we do at that facility is not just test and go. We do testing car side, but there is a physician or APP that actually does an assessment of each patient. And if we're concerned that they may be sicker than we'd be comfortable with sending them home, we actually have what we call a red clinic adjacent to the flu testing site where we can examine that patient more fully, listen to heart and lungs, and even provide some treatment like respiratory therapy, medications, and such. So we're doing much more than just testing.
So how does that assessment work? Is that all determined by, you know, what we hear is a swab for the COVID-19 or the flu test, or are there questions asked?
There's questions. So we actually take some vitals. We check the oxygen saturation or how much oxygen is in the blood, as well as the patient's heart rate and temperature. So if anything is concerning with the vitals, and then we also do a fairly full history about any of the symptoms they may be having, as well as conditions that would increase their risk from COVID-19. And obviously, we're looking at the patient and making sure that they look healthy, or if they look sick, and that will also help us in our assessment.
I know that you can't go into details about specific individuals, but what are you all seeing overall there in terms of, I don't know, percentage of people who might pull up and need additional care?
We usually see between 4 to 10 a day at each of these sites, and we're screening probably between 30 to 50 patients each day. So not it's a fair percentage, but not too many. And we've only really sent a few to the hospital, and we've been really testing in all sites for around 2 months.
And so how does this particular testing work? I know it's a drive-through situation, but mm-hmm. somebody pulls up, then what happens?
So essentially, we have a traffic controller, which brings them into the site safely. A physician or APP approaches the car. We talk to the patient, take their vitals, as I mentioned, and then if they are having symptoms that are significant for COVID-19 or have risk factors, certainly first responders as well as healthcare workers, we're going ahead and we swab for COVID-19. We are increasing the amount of testing we're doing all the time because of the availability of tests. So those we move from those that were just most critical to test to really more broadly testing anyone who has any symptom at all that could be related to COVID-19. The swab is collected. We send that for processing. It takes about 3 to 5 days at most, and at best, it takes about a day. So it just depends on how many tests in the community are being sent to the different sites we use. But then the patient is either directed inside if they are sicker than we would like and want to do additional evaluation, or they're sent on their way. The whole process takes probably less than 10 minutes.
Is this still a test that's available only to people who are exhibiting some type of symptoms, or is it open to anyone who feels like they want to have a test?
So we are not doing screening at this time for the greater community without symptoms, but we are doing screening for patients who have had a potential exposure. So those patients who have had an exposure and no symptoms, we would go ahead and test.
So perhaps if someone at a workplace or someone in
correct.
A household tested positive?
That's correct.
And we're talking with Dr. Brianna McFaughn. She's the medical director of primary care at Mercy Health Physicians. Specifically today, we're talking about Mercy Health's relationship in Bond Hill and this relatively new testing site there that opened in April for both COVID-19 and flu. How much does this test cost?
So we are not collecting any copays for the testing. So the cost is covered by insurance. So that's the way we've decided to set that up.
And how accurate is the test? I know you said it can be a day before you get results, 3 to 5 days before you get results. Do you have a percentage on the accuracy?
The test itself that we're using, it runs around 95% specificity and sensitivity, which is very highly accurate. No test is 100%, but this is quite good.
And you're also testing for flu. What are, you know, this time of year or maybe a month or two ago, we'd probably talk more about it. We talk about flu cases and what the level of flu is like in our region. What are you seeing for flu cases right now as it relates to last year or years past?
It's pretty incredible. Once we started isolating, our flu season ended in less than 2 weeks. So it was definitely very powerful for that particular virus to really almost completely end that flu season. We tested maybe 3 weeks ago 50 patients all in one day for flu, and none of them had flu. So we're really not seeing flu anymore at all.
So when you say isolating it, tell us what that means in relationship to the regular seasonal flu.
So the isolation that we did as far as the stay-at-home order from the governor and the state, that's the time where we saw our flu season end. So I believe that social distancing that was put in place did an excellent job in ending the flu season.
Okay, so you're talking about the policies that were enacted related to COVID-19. They actually
Correct.
Had a pretty significant impact on the flu.
They did.
Okay. So do you think there's more need for more facilities like the one in Bond Hill?
I do. I think, Ohio overall is behind in the amount of testing we've done in our state. We've been in the 40-41 position in America. All of our organizations across the city and across the state, hospital systems and pharmacies even, need to get involved in testing. So we are actually adding a sixth site for testing in our Deerfield location in Mason. Again, just trying to provide widespread testing in all the communities that we exist in. But I believe we won't be able to do this without participation of all the healthcare organizations in Cincinnati.
And what about the particular location in Bond Hill? How important is it to be in communities that may be of lower income or maybe a community of color?
That's very important, and we do have a close relationship with the community providers there, with local churches and organizations through our Avondale office and Dr. Keith Melvin. So they were instrumental in reaching out to us and asking for the site, and we responded within, I think, a day. We opened that site over the weekend and have been up and running it ever since. It's actually quite a need. We have tested almost double the amount of patients at the Bond Hill Flu Clinic than all the other sites. We've tested over 1,000 patients at that particular site within a month, which is double what we've done in any of our other clinics within 2 months. So we appreciate really them reaching out and letting us know that the need was there. And we even adjusted our hours just based on demand and ran that Monday through Saturday starting at 7:30 a.m. And we ended it sooner than 5. 4:30 seemed to be the time that people needed. So it's been an incredible honor to be there and serving that community on where, you know, access can be lacking.
We're talking about it as a drive-through or drive-up testing site.
Mm-hmm.
In some of these communities, there may not be vehicle access. Is it also available to people who walk up?
Absolutely, yes. We have a really nice large tent set up that is actually borrowed from the Jewish Hospital for outdoor events. So it can hold two cars that can drive up, and there are seats inside for walk-up patients.
Okay, so if someone does walk up, they will enter a vehicle?
No, we have seats, and we have those spaced probably more about 12 feet apart.
I got you. You're talking about seats inside the tent, not inside something that would drive them up. My apologies.
That's
I got
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep, they can walk right up to the tent.
So we talked about the need for more widespread testing. One area where we've not seen much testing really anywhere, certainly not around here, is for people who may not be symptomatic, who may not feel any symptoms, but do want the reassurance of knowing whether they have it or have had it. What are your thoughts as a medical professional on the need for expanded testing in a more universal capacity?
I think we're focusing right now on patients who have potential exposures or symptoms, and the approach will be contact tracing. So we may be able to locate those patients who might not have symptoms but have had an exposure and be able to test those. And in other disease conditions, this is really what's been proven to be the best way to really combat a disease, an infectious disease. So that's really the process that we're starting up in coordination with the Ohio Health Department and local health departments. They have set up a system where we can test someone if they're positive, and within 2 days, they're reaching out and contacting everyone that patient has been in contact with. So those are also asymptomatic patients that will be tested. I think it would be really nice to offer that to every person who wanted to be tested. If we could test our whole community, that would be wonderful. And we may have capacity for that. It's probably still going to take about another month. Participation of retail centers like Kroger and CVS, I was really excited when I heard that they're starting to do that, because those type of places are perfect for patients who aren't having symptoms.
And Dr. McFaughn, we deal with the seasonal flu every year, and so it's not unfamiliar to people like you or people in your line of work and at offices like yours. I'm wondering if you've learned anything from this current pandemic about infectious disease and our readiness for it and the way that we might prepare for something similar in the future.
I think the main teaching is the way that we really run our health system. In my mind, it's a higher level, in my opinion. We're running medicine right now for profit. And so medicine is focused on more expensive, better reimbursed procedures and specialty treatment, and not public health, because public health really doesn't pay the bills. Unfortunately, we have to be ready to respond in an event of a pandemic like this. And I think that's really shown where, our national stockpiles and even the preparedness of the local hospitals really didn't have what they needed and supplies and things like that to really take care of patients. And we had to scramble to make it happen. And we did. The frontline workers took a stand and took care of patients. But I really think that's the lesson learned here, is we need to put more focus on public health. And when emergencies happen, we need to be ready.
Dr. Brianna McFaughn is the medical director of primary care at Mercy Health Physicians. Dr. McFaughn, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Joining us now is Kiana Trebue. She's the Executive Director of Population Health Strategies at the Health Collaborative. She's the CEO of Trebue Leadership, and she's also a council member in Woodlawn. Kiana, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Felicia Beckham. She's a family practitioner nurse with the Healthcare Connection. Felicia, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Kiana, let's start with you. We've been using the term health disparity since the top of the show here, and I know it's something that people are hearing in other media outlets pretty regularly, but I'm wondering if you can help give a definition for us so that we better understand it.
Sure. So health disparities, really in the simple terms, are differences in health status or health outcomes that are closely linked with differing social, economic, and environmental disadvantages. So health disparities really affect groups who have systematically experienced some greater obstacles to access to health care, to be able to do the things that would allow them to live a healthy life. In particular, where we see the most disparities is based on race or ethnicity. We can also see health disparities depending on an individual's age, where they live, zip code as an example, their mental health, and other things. But really, those health disparities are differences in health outcomes that can't be explained by anything other than those social or economic conditions.
And we talked in our earlier segment on this show today about some of the different neighborhoods in Cincinnati that are inordinately impacted by positive COVID-19 cases, and they do tend to be lower income or communities of color. What are you learning in your role at the Health Collaborative by looking at a map like that and understanding health disparities amid this current pandemic?
Sure. So I guess I'll start by saying, you know, unfortunately, what we are seeing as a result of this pandemic, the disparities that we're seeing are not surprising. We see those disparities, and we've seen those disparities for quite some time when you look at other health conditions like diabetes, infant mortality, obesity, health, hypertension, and other health conditions. So it's not surprising, unfortunately, that we're seeing some of those same disparities when it comes to COVID-19. Looking at zip codes where we see a lot of individuals that are racial and ethnic minorities, we see in those low-income areas where people are, the population is very dense and people are living very close together, where we are seeing food deserts, as an example, where there's not a lot of access to healthy food or good, adequate housing, safe neighborhoods. So all of those things are working together, unfortunately, and shining a light on these disparities as a result of the pandemic. As a result, what we need to do and what we're really working hard to do at the Health Collaborative, along with our health system partners and other providers, is to think about some targeted responses. I know earlier you spoke with Mercy Health about their flu clinic in Bon Hill. And so to have more like that, we need to have more targeted interventions where we're able to look at that data and let that data drive our response.
And that's Kiana Trebue. She's with the Health Collaborative. We're also joined today on the phone by Felicia Beckham, a family practitioner nurse with the Healthcare Connection. Felicia, before we talk about what some of your patients are talking about to you amid this COVID-19 pandemic, how are you doing and how are your colleagues doing in the face of all of this?
Yes, thank you for asking. We're actually adjusting to the new normal, if that makes sense. In the beginning, we're a little uncertain in regards to the direction of where this pandemic could influence how we practice, but in the midst of it, how we interact with each other. So really, we have formed a stronger community to bring us together and else to support us in a different way so we can all be safe and healthy.
And I understand that you are hearing from some patients, many of whom are poor, that have tested positive for COVID-19 and then feel like they have to go to work anyway. Can you talk a little bit about that as we discuss these disparities as they relate to socioeconomic status?
Yeah, so the patients, when you talk about or look or view health, their view on health is different than how I view it. So when we talk about something that impacts their health, they are the breadwinners. They are the actual people that have to get up and have to go to work. They do not have an option. So it's survival for them. So if they do not go in, then they do not have any money for their family. So it is an option. I'm sorry, it's not an option for them to go forth with their daily living because it's really impacting them and how they can survive. Not just live, but survive. So when we talk about this vulnerable population, this is a community that really is impacted because the lower income, they're needing to work longer hours, and also, you know, looking at what impacts their social status is a barrier for them to actually be successful in their healthy living.
And I imagine that a lot of these patients are essential workers and not essential workers as you are in the medical field. We're talking about some of the businesses that have remained open for public use during these stay-at-home orders, like grocery stores. Is that what you're seeing?
Absolutely. So we have patients that work, you know, at the grocery store. They work at the pizza place. They work on the metro. They work, you know, for the metro business. So when we look at the exposure of a patient, we're talking about a patient that may use public transportation that increases their risk. We are seeing the patients that live in apartment buildings that increase their risk in regards to contact. And then we also see where it's not just their family; it may be two or three other different families that live with them, or different generations that may live with them in that building. So that increases their risk as well. And then they have to go to work because they have to survive. So in the midst of all of that, that increases their risk of getting exposed to it. And then also if their job just says, hey, you know, we had a positive patient, then they are obligated to actually come in and get tested. Some are not. Again, it's about survival. So when we look at a patient, you know, when we say you have to stay home for 2 weeks, that brings a lot of anxiety. That brings a lot of worry because they do not know how they're going to survive.
And we're talking with Felicia Backham, a family practitioner nurse with Healthcare Connection, and also Kiana Trebue, the Executive Director of Population Health Strategies at the Health Collaborative. Kiana, I'd like your reaction to some of the points that Felicia was making here. I imagine that we're also dealing with some people who are poor and live alone and maybe older and part of the more vulnerable population as it relates to COVID-19 infection, but still have to go out and shop for themselves and do all the essential things that we're still allowed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And what she is experiencing are the exact same things that we're hearing from our partner organizations. One of the things that the Health Collaborative does, I have the pleasure of co-leading a vulnerable populations work group on behalf of the Health Collaborative that is inclusive of representatives from our health systems, our federally qualified health centers and community health centers, and also really community-based organizations. And so I definitely want to make sure that we mention those community-based organizations because oftentimes they're the ones that have the strongest relationships with these individuals and these populations that are experiencing some of these disparities. And so they have firsthand knowledge of how this is impacting not only individuals, but families and entire communities of people. When we talk about essential workers, as you mentioned, it's not just our healthcare providers. You know, it is other essential jobs like food service, retail, janitorial services, childcare providers. Oftentimes, those are more than often held by people of color. Those are often also lower paying jobs as well. And so the opportunities to stay home or work remotely or work from home are just not there. And individuals are literally having to decide between going to work and being exposed to this deadly virus or not going to work and running the risk of, you know, losing their homes or not being able to feed their families. And so it's truly a catch-22 situation. And that is why it's really important that we look at this our response through a health equity lens and really take into consideration the unique needs of these specific populations. And we're not able to do that unless we have representation of those specific populations at the table making those decisions. We can't make those decisions on behalf of individuals without their input.
Kiana, when the decisions are made and some of these orders are handed down or suggestions, whether it be staying at home, in enacting social distancing orders, or the suggestion of wearing masks while out in public, are you finding, based on your work, that minority populations, poorer populations, are responding to these orders and suggestions?
I think as much as possible. I think one of the things that we definitely need to consider is when we put messaging out there, we have to consider how that message is coming across and who's delivering that message. Oftentimes we go to that low-hanging fruit and we push these messages out through these traditional avenues, but we really need to take into consideration that not everyone has access to the internet, as an example, to be able to hear those messages and understand those messages. In addition to that, you know, in the newspaper and places like that, I think we have to be really creative and innovative to make sure that our responses are culturally competent. And then also that goes back to the importance of figuring out who the leaders are in those communities that people respect and people listen to so that they can make sure that those messages are being heard. I think the intention is for everyone to be able to adhere to the stay-at-home orders and the guidelines around social distancing, around wearing masks. But I think we also have to take into consideration that those things are not easy to do. Again, as we think about those more densely populated areas, it's very hard to social distance when you're living in a home, a multi-generational home, or a home with multiple families living in one space. And so we have to be able to make those adjustments and concessions and think about those things, that it's not as easy oftentimes as it sounds for some of us to social distance or self-isolate or wear a mask I think that we have to take those things into consideration and make those adjustments for those populations and those cultures that it's not as easy for them to do that.
We're talking with Kiana Trebue, Executive Director of Population Health Strategies at the Healthcare Collaborative. And we also have Felicia Beckham, a family practitioner nurse with the Healthcare Connection. Felicia, when you're dealing with patients who come in who are either sick or concerned about becoming sick and want to be treated, what are you seeing in the community as it relates to their either skepticism or fear about the virus?
Yeah, so patients do not want to step near any healthcare centers. We have patients that are having heart attacks and have different symptoms that would bring them into a hospital setting or a clinic setting, but because of the fear of them contracting it from here, they would rather stay at home. So the Healthcare Connection has actually moved towards the telephone visits and also virtual visits to make their visits more accessible for them. So we're able to have these visits and, you know, we can actually talk with them in the comfort of their home so they can be a little bit more vulnerable with us. So we're able to kind of dive into the psyche of why they're feeling anxious and what brings this anxiety on because of this pandemic, because mental health, the domestic violence, and then also the fear of the pandemic has really turned into normal patients that can deal with this, and we see normal patients that cannot deal with this. So we do have a service, a behavioral health consultant that are actually on site with us that we're able to help to get through these times, especially offering the different coping skills, different interventions and therapies that we can do to help them via virtual visit or telephone visit to help just bring the stress down, but also to educate. I had a patient say, hey, if you test me, that means I'm going to die from COVID. And it is disturbing to me to hear that, because what they see in the media is not what we're seeing here. So I have to explain to patients that 80% of these cases that are tested positive have very mild cases, and you're able to be managed at home. That's only 20%. So they do have a lot of fear because of what they're seeing, but not what they're hearing within the community. So I think bringing awareness to what is actually going on in Cincinnati from a perspective of making sure different, as Kiana mentioned, different communities and their approach and how things are delivered can be very, very helpful. Now, we only are only seeing, you know, just a number of patients, but if we can get this and disperse this information out, it will be very helpful from a mental health standpoint, but also from a community standpoint to help improve patients' anxiety, depression, but even also just their overall health, because they know that that is not what we're seeing here.
And Kiana, I've got 30 seconds left. What would you say is most needed to bring some solutions about to eliminate these disparities? I've got 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Targeted response. We need to be able to look at the data. The data will let us know where we need to show our efforts. We need more community-wide testing like what Mercy Health has done in those targeted areas where we're seeing the most disparities in COVID-19, and that will help.
Kiana Trebue from the Health Collaborative, also a council member in Woodlawn, and also Felicia Beckham, a family practitioner nurse with the Healthcare Connection. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.